welcome everyone to an edition of Governed by God, a biblical look at law, civics, and government. My name is Eric Leupold. Thank you for joining me this morning. Today, I have an interview with a fellow Christian podcaster, Daniel Minnick, and I'll give a brief introduction about him in a little bit. But first, I want to do our law of the day. So if you wanted to join me in taking a look at scripture, the law we're going to be looking at is Exodus chapter 22, verses 2 through 4. If a thief is found breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there shall be no blood guilt for him. But if the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guilt for him. He shall surely pay. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the stolen beast is found alive in his possession, whether it is an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. All right, pretty simple law, straightforward. But there's a couple things to point out before we get into application of this law. First is that a distinction is made here between two different situations. The first is a situation at nighttime when everyone is sleeping, there's a lot of uncertainty, there's a lot of confusion, if you will, and the individual breaks in the home and there's a struggle of some kind. And in this situation, if lethal force is used against the thief, the owner is not held accountable or held liable to it. The owner doesn't know why the thief is there. The owner might have a weapon, but be unable to see very clearly to use it. Of course, there's very little light. In those days, there would be no light switches. You'd have to light a candle. And again, it'd be a very confusing situation. And in this case, the benefit of the doubt is given to the owner. He doesn't know whether the individual, the thief, is actually trying to kill them or do something even worse to, you know, a wife or children, and not just there to steal an ox or a donkey. The second scenario takes place during the day or at a time when more information is known about the situation. Again, the thief breaks in during the day. Obviously there's light, the owner can see what's going on, can see what the thief is doing, whether he's armed or not, whether he's a real threat or not, and then make a more informed decision. Now, keep in mind, if a thief were to break in during the day, that's a very desperate situation. Obviously, you would prefer to do it at night because you have the cover of darkness and surprise. But during the day, that would imply that the person is in truly a desperate situation if they're so hungry, so impoverished that they have to break in during the day. But also keep in mind that the more knowledge that the owner has, the more responsibility they have. So in this case, the life of the thief is more important than getting the item back right at that time. The thief can be detained. But if the sun has risen, or if there's enough information, daylight, things like that, he cannot be killed. The owner must use self-control in this manner. If the owner were to kill him knowingly, it's clear as day, he knows that he's a thief, the thief is running away, has the object, but if the owner just kills him anyways, there is guilt upon the owner. Now, regardless, if the thief is caught, of course, he must pay back. And in this case, he must pay back double what is owed, whether it's a sheep, ox, or donkey, or goat, whatever the case may be. He must return the stolen item plus additional costs. Now, the reason why there are these additional costs is because there's a loss of labor. I mean, if the thief steals the farmer's ox, that's his means of work, of farming and labor. So there's a loss of labor, there's a loss of productivity, there's also a loss of time if the farmer is spending a lot of time looking for the lost item. He didn't know it was stolen, perhaps, and the thief got away with it. There's also a loss of, due to stress and inconvenience there. Again, just is causing problems in the farmer's life. So the thief must make restitution monetarily. If he can't pay double, he has to be sold into slavery. Now, please understand, this is not the typical concept of slavery that an American might understand it. It's not ethnic or race-based. It's not lifetime servitude. He could work off the debt, essentially. And the slavery would not last forever. I mean, in the context of Israel, a Hebrew slave could only be a slave for 6 years. On the seventh year, he had to be set free. So essentially, it was a short-term debt, a short-term enslavement, if you will. And the purpose in this particular case is to simply pay back what is owed. As soon as the individual works to pay back his debt, he's done. He's free. It's not a lifetime. And even if he can't pay it all back, he's free on the seventh year anyways. So that's the worst case scenario for the thief, is that he's in a short-term debt scenario. Now, how about some application for this law? Well, the law seeks restitution between the two parties involved. The victim is to receive monetary damages, not the government, not the state, not the central authority there. The criminal must work to pay back what has been lost. This is good for the victim because the victim gets satisfaction for the loss of property and time, monetary satisfaction. The victim does not have to pay taxes to pay to keep the thief in prison and clothing him and feeding him and entertaining him and all of that stuff. It's also good for the thief because he can simply be free if he has the money and pays back double what he owes. He's done. He goes free. It's over. He's also only enslaved to pay back the debt, and it's a short-term slavery. He still would have rights as a slave, by the way, under biblical law. He cannot be killed. And per biblical law, if a slave is injured, if the master hurts a slave, the slave must go free. Okay, like knocks a tooth out or anything like that, kind of, you know, serious damage. And of course, if the slave is murdered, the owner or the master is held accountable for that and could lose his own life as well. So the slave has rights, and the purpose here is just to pay back the debt. And he learns the value of hard work, by the way. The thief does. He learns the value of hard work. Consider what Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28 says. Paul writes this, "Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need." So it's a good law for both parties involved, and it teaches the thief the value of hard work and that stealing is not the right way. It's not the way to go. Now, other laws in the world are that deviate from God's law, they're cruel and they're unkind. And I'll show you why. Let's give you a couple examples. First, in some nations, thieves have their hands cut off, which is a very cruel punishment. You know, some might think that's smart or wise, but the problem is it prevents the thief from working. If you lose a hand, the thief can't really do labor or as much labor anymore. So it prevents the thief from engaging in honest work. It also makes the thief dependent upon others. If he loses a hand, now he has to beg. Now someone has to take care of him. So rather than provide for himself, he has to be provided for. Now, in the modern culture, such as the United States today, thieves go to prison a lot of the time. And again, I have a big problem with the prison system. I think it's very unbiblical. But what ends up happening is the victim has to pay to support the thief. The victim pays via taxes to house and clothe and feed this thief. And the thief does not learn the value of hard work and might be in jail longer than 7 years. So way worse than the slavery of the Bible here. And the victim never gets the restitution. If the thief doesn't have the money, you know, right, the thief just goes to jail, but the thief is never required to pay that person back and doesn't have to work for it. So there is no restitution given to the victim. So ultimately, God's law is wise and good and something that we need to really, really think about and consider for our own laws today. So just wanted to share that law today with you. Hope you found it interesting, and I encourage you to look at that and reflect upon it as well. But now, I want to get into our main topic. So today, I had the opportunity to interview Daniel Minnick, who is the host of the Truth Espresso podcast, also part of the Christian podcast community, of which Governed by God, my podcast, is a part of. Daniel Minnick is a software engineer, has a bachelor's degree in computer science, and a master's in information systems. Now, Truth Espresso, on that podcast, he covers a lot of different topics, a lot of different worldview topics. And one such topic that I found particularly interesting on his podcast is that of economics. Daniel has a wonderful brain. He can think things through way better than I can. And so the topic that we're going to discuss together is that of economics, money, debt, and basically some of the problems that we see in the United States and America regarding our economic system and the things that are going on with it that are unbiblical. And so we do take a look at some of the laws in Scripture regarding that. So I really do hope you enjoy this discussion with Daniel Minnick from Truth Espresso. And if you want to take a look at his podcast, just go to truthespresso.com. That's truth, T-R-U-T-H, and then S-P-R-E-S-S-O.com. And without further ado, my discussion with Daniel Minnick. All right, Dan, I really appreciate you joining me this evening to have a good conversation on the topic of economics. It's very, obviously, a very broad topic. And just for our listeners out there, you're the host of Truth Espresso, and I've had a chance to listen to a couple episodes and have really appreciated it. And so I'm glad to have you on the show today here on Governed by God, because you and I kind of cover some of the same topics regarding how law, government, economics should all fall under Scripture and God's standard for living. So I kind of just wanted to open it up to you, being someone who, you know, you're very familiar with economics and some of the unbiblical things that are happening in our culture today, more specifically on the American issue. What do you see as some of the big problems, the big unbiblical issues economically in our culture?
Well, yes, first of all, thank you, Eric, for allowing me to be on your podcast, Governed by God. And as you said, we have a lot of similar interests there, and seeing the world through the lens of God's law, as he spells out in the Bible. And when it comes to the issue of economics, I think that it's a very deep and complicated issue that I really wish a lot more people would understand. Basically, economics is kind of like, if you think of it like an onion, there are a lot of layers to it. But uh-huh. When you peel back the layers and get to the core, economics is very simple. Yeah. And it all comes down to the idea of what is money and what is the purpose of money and what would be honest money versus a dishonest money. Mm-hmm. And so I think when it comes to economics and all the problems that we see, when we see like rampant government spending on doling out favors to corrupt organizations, mm-hmm. Helping government bureaucrats and banks helping out their friends while basically leaving the average person high and dry, I think all of it ultimately gets traced back to, why is that even possible? And the reason it's possible has to do with the whole money system that I believe departs from what the Bible prescribes as far as what is an honest money and what is a dishonest form of money, and yeah, the monopoly on money.
Hmm. You know, you mentioned some of the spending from the government, and obviously, you know, we're a year plus into this pandemic, and now many of us have gotten multiple stimulus checks, and a lot of people that I talk to, they don't really see any problem with it per se, or they're not really bothered by the getting the money. I mean, the only thing that really bothers them is if they don't get it. So, you know, as long as they get it, they're cool with it. And I don't know, I imagine you've had some similar conversations, but I try to get people to think about that money, like, it just doesn't come out of thin air. You know, it's not really real, and it's going to be problems in the future. So it's kind of that topic of fake or fiat money. Can you speak a little bit about the problem that you see with this kind of spending and essentially printing of money by the government?
Yeah. So first, I'd like to come up with a definition of money, just so we know exactly what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. The definition of money that I came up with for my podcast, Truth Espresso, is any good, whether tangible or intangible, whose primary use is as a medium of exchange. And so money is basically what facilitates transactions. It's anything that's in the middle of trading different goods and services. Basically, it gets in the middle of barter and makes barter essentially easier. And if we want to look at what a biblical money is, we look at the characteristics of a money. So technically, any good can be used as a money, because I said it's a good, but certain characteristics make some things better suited as money. These characteristics are that, number one, it's relatively scarce, you know. So if everyone lives at the ocean and you try to use sand as money, that's not going to work very well, because you can't even contain how much sand you use that would make it valuable for transactions. So relatively scarce. Another number two, it's portable. You need to be able to carry it around. Otherwise, it makes it hard to transact in a marketplace. Number three is it's divisible. Number four, it's fungible. In other words, every unit of money has the same value as any other unit of the same denomination. Number five, it's durable, you know, like say dirt or something that can erode or wither is not going to last long. And therefore, if a good is durable, that makes it work better as money. So you could store it longer, you can save it, and you can plan your spending when you need it. And then finally, which this I think is important for biblical money, as opposed to the system we have today, number six, is that money has utility. In other words, it has valuable uses. Like, so what makes something a good money is that it itself is a good that has, you know, factors. Like, say, for instance, if we take gold, you know, gold isn't just shiny and beautiful. It also is, you know, it's malleable. You can shape it. It conducts electricity. It's used in products like USB devices. And so the reason people found something like gold valuable is that it actually has uses, it has utility, and that's how it became historically valuable for money. So I mentioned that there are many things, you know, agricultural produce, wampum, seashells, large stones, precious metals, and paper have historically been used as money. But what things have been tested, time-tested, that people have used for thousands of years, as the Bible shows, are things like gold and silver, because they have all of those features, those characteristics of a good money. And so
you would say that, I mean, it seems like these six rules, or these six characteristics, I should say, they make sense. But is it the case that they just kind of happened naturally as humans engaged in commerce with each other, that it just so happened, I guess I'm trying to say is somebody in the ancient world didn't just sit down and say, okay, look, I need something that does this, 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 and this, and this, and then he goes through his list of items, you know, piece of rock, no, cow, no, you know, piece of wood, no, and then he lands on gold. Or is it more just it naturally came about that over time, generally speaking, throughout the world, gold and silver, precious stones, rose to the top as far as the best forms of money, medium exchange, because of those qualities. But it's not that somebody was explicitly trying to find those qualities. Does that make sense?
Yes, it's money is definitely an indirect, unintentional discovery of natural free market processes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we have the revelation of God. And if we look at Genesis chapter 2, verses 11 through 12, we see that God created money naturally, even if he didn't just dictate down from heaven to some kind of government and say, you will use gold and silver as money. But yeah, from the start, naturally, we see it says the name of the first, referring to rivers, that is it which compasseth the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold, and the gold of that land is good. There is delium and the onyx stone. And so we see that God created things, if it seems like he intended them to be discovered and used naturally as money. And so, you know, as I mentioned, people used different things that might have had one or two or several of the characteristics that make sense as money, but it seems like God naturally created things, you know, gold, silver, precious stones with their characteristics that makes them naturally suited as money, but he never set up anything that would be like a central government and dictated to them, you will create the money and you will control the money and the supply of money.
I bet you this is probably a very in-depth question, but, you know, how did we get, in a way, I mean, maybe in a nutshell or in 5 minutes or less, like from that idea to where we are today, as far as like now we just go around handing these pieces of paper with people's faces on it, and we as humans think that that has value, or even we just use, you know, digital ones and zeros, credit or electronic money. Like, where did the disconnect happen, or how did it come to this?
Yeah, it's definitely a complicated answer that would be needed for that question. I mean, I can give kind of a hypothetical story, you know, where obviously the invention of print paper and the printing press, I think it was the Chinese who actually invented paper, you know, was a good thing for the economy because, you know, allows us to keep records better. It's better for writing and printing things and books, disseminating information. And I would say that there's nothing wrong with using paper itself as a currency, as long as we understand how it should be limited. It's like, so if we're going to use paper, like really we should use it. And in history, it was used as a money substitute. In other words, a bank, like people would store their gold or silver at a bank, and then the bank would issue what were called warehouse receipts in paper. And the paper itself, you know, it's a lot lighter. It's much more portable, actually, than gold and silver. And, you know, maybe if someone on the street sees some a bag with shiny stuff, you know, on your person, you might have more of a risk of getting mugged and robbed. So paper, the warehouse receipts made it much easier to carry money. And then because it represented gold and silver in a bank, the warehouse receipts would be treated as a substitute for the money. And so people would exchange these warehouse receipts for goods and services because the person who bore the note would know that he can take that warehouse receipt to a bank and redeem it for the gold and silver. And so, you know, there is a role that things like money substitutes, instruments such as paper, can play a role in facilitating commerce. But then the problem happens when the banks realize that they could try to get away with lending out more paper, printing more paper than they actually have money in the vault. And that's exactly what has happened throughout history. And then when people start to get suspicious that maybe the bank, it was not being honest and they didn't really have their money in safekeeping at the bank, they would try to come to the bank to get their real money and redeem the receipts. But if there's more receipts than there is money in the vault, then you have a bank run and you know, you have a difficult situation, and that exposed the problems with the bank. But today people think the best way to avoid a bank run is to insure deposits. You know, we have what's in the United States, what's called the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, to ensure that banks can use inflation to give you your money back. But that's not really the solution. The solution is honest money, that your receipts should represent real money, such as historically what was gold and silver.
So you can't go to the bank today and get some gold or silver by turning in your bank notes.
Yes, not anymore. Historically speaking, in the United States, the certificates, the money, used to say that you could redeem it in gold at the bank, but no longer, because the United States went off the gold standard. And, you know, we could get into history of that, such as, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his New Deal programs and his efforts to expand the money supply. He knew that his spending would result in inflation. So then he had the gold confiscation laws. People weren't allowed to have gold because, you know, that would prevent the government from being able to expand and spend money on projects in their false notion that was what the economy needed. Actually, it was theft from the labor of the citizenry. But then gold was actually illegal to hold there until after, you know, until the 1970s. But then that would, you know, we'd get into the history of the wars and the Bretton Woods Accords and stuff like that.
But. Obviously we can't get gold today. Well, you can still get gold, but not at the bank. You said that per the FDIC, you have a situation where the bank has this money that it gets from its patrons, its customers, and then it's hoping that not every single person comes back for their money at the same time. So it's kind of taking a little bit of a risk or a gamble, and it's a little dishonest, obviously, and it uses that money. It spends it or loans it or whatever. But like you said, if everyone runs on the bank, the FDIC, is that basically nothing more than another higher bank, the federal bank, just promises to backfill the other bank with the cash? Like, how does that work?
Yes. Originally, I believe when it was established, it would insure deposits up to $10,000. Now it's been $250,000 for quite a while. So if you have one bank account that you have millions of dollars in, if somehow there were a bank run, you would only get $250,000 insured, you know, to replace it. But, you know, yeah, that is the solution that the government provides to avoid bank runs. But of course, I believe that's not the correct solution.
Yeah, because is it nothing more than just deception and theft? Like, what makes it, is that why it's bad?
Yeah, I mean, this would go back to the legalized institutional practice of fractional reserve banking. I mean, fractional reserve banking was kind of something that, you know, banks tried to do and get away with. But now with the central bank, especially the Federal Reserve System that started in 1913, now you have legalized, institutionalized fractional reserve banking as the engine for the economy. And what fractional reserve banking is that a bank can lend out money that more money than it has in reserves in its vault. So let's say, you know, you have what's called the reserve ratio that the Federal Reserve sets. And so if, say, for instance, the reserve ratio is 10%, that means that the bank is required to have in its vaults 10% of the cash that in total it lends out to borrowers. So it could lend out, you know, nine times, you know, if I'm calculating correctly, what it has in the vaults. And so definitely that you'd see like, well, that should cause a bank run, but now that it's institutionalized and people don't understand what's going on, then the banks are making money and with their loans and inflating the supply of money, which we could talk about what inflation is and what the Bible says about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically it's like our purchasing power, the how much we could buy with a dollar, it gets spread thin. We can buy less with it as the banks end up getting more of the purchasing power because they could lend out, they can create new money and lend out what they don't have, what they haven't earned.
Yeah.
And we get to use money that we have to work to earn and see its purchasing power stolen from us.
Yeah. So that's what I wanted to go to next, because whenever I, you know, with these, especially with these stimulus checks and you're getting the government spending trillions of dollars and no one seems to bat an eye at it. And I just inform people like, well, I can't see how it's going to avoid inflation, because it just seems like the money is coming out of thin air. It's not money that we've saved in kind of like a rainy day fund. Like maybe it'd be one thing if the government had a balanced budget and we had a surplus and we had 10% every year saved for the rainy day fund. And then rainy day happens, you know, pandemic, and now you have $2 trillion saved that's actually legitimate real money that you can actually, you know, spend as you see fit. But what's happening here is we're in debt, we have a deficit, we spend more than we take in, and then we're just going to create more money out of thin air. And what I tell people kind of tongue in cheek is that it's nothing more than Chuck E. Cheese tokens. Like it's not it's just not going to go very well. It's going to diminish the value, which I try to explain inflation, but maybe for my listeners, you can please explain how that is inflation and how inflation is a damaging thing.
Yeah. So when I mentioned what qualifies as a good money, one of the features is that it's relatively scarce and built into, say, gold and silver that has to be mined, and you know, that they're relatively scarce metals, so they hold their value. They can't really be manipulated as easily. But inflation is at least historically defined, which is the definition I'm holding to, inflation is an increase in the supply of money that ultimately results in an increase in prices. Now, when you hear economists today talk about inflation, mostly they talk about rising prices, but that's not what inflation is. Inflation is a monetary phenomenon. It has to do with the supply of money itself, which results in rising prices. But by focusing on defining inflation now as just an increase in prices, they hide the cause of it. But so now, what is the effect of this when the money supply is increased? Inflation doesn't simply mean that the government creates new money and then distributes the results in proportion to what everyone has. In other words, if the government doubles the money supply, it's not as if everyone's money holdings simply double. You know, that would make inflation really have no other effect than to adjust price figures, but and everyone would still be as wealthy as before. But that is far from what inflation actually is. Inflation inflation in practice is no different in effect than counterfeiting. Those who have the legal privilege to print new money at will can benefit themselves and their favored parties, all their friends. The counterfeiter or his friends who get this new money can, of course, buy goods and services at their current prices. And as they buy a portion of the supply of goods and services, and their counterfeited money circulates, prices eventually adjust to reflect the new ratio of the money supply to the currently available supply of goods and services. So the counterfeiter and their favored friends benefit from this because they get free goods and services with the money that they create. But who loses? It's those who do honest work and are not connected to the scheme. What they earn for their work will tend to lag behind the the increase in prices. This is really a theft of labor. Any savings that they have worked to set aside becomes less valuable as each unit of money can buy less. So it really is theft.
Yeah, I was just trying to think about, in its simplest form, kind of like if I was in my basement with a printing press that could print counterfeit bills. Let's say I get like $1 million. I made $1 million. And no one else knows that. And now I can take advantage of the fact that the market, you know, the prices of a car, of a house or whatever, they're all the same. But as I start buying all this stuff and the money starts to go out into the world, then, you know, as I'm buying more and more stuff, the prices of those items will raise. So I get the benefit of the low prices at the beginning. So I get all the stuff. And then as my money starts going out into the market, those people, they get more money. Maybe they're able to buy some stuff at a decent price before it rises high. But the person at the very end of the whip or of the rope, the prices have all increased. The market is already adjusted when they're finally seeing the money, if you will. And so those people are the marginalized, the ones that get hurt the most, which are, I guess, I would assume typically the poor, because the first people that are getting the money from the big injection from the government are like people that need the big loans, corporate, big business, that kind of stuff. But the average laborer who's poor isn't going to see that until the prices have all raised. Is that a fair understanding?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what inflation does and who it affects. You know, those who are connected to the scheme get cheaper goods and services or even free goods and services because they create the money. And then because the prices rise as the money supply grows and prices readjust, those who are on fixed incomes, you know, the working middle class and poor, those who save money and, you know, the fatherless and the widows, as the Bible talks about a lot, they're the ones who suffer the most from this scheme of counterfeiting, legalized, monopolized counterfeiting.
Yeah, and I also was thinking of the folks that are, because you mentioned the widow, but the folks that are retired too, because you know, they worked all their lives and they are, you know, let's say they invested or saved, you know, several million dollars and they're living off the interest or whatever, but they planned their retirement off of a certain cost of living and a certain level of lifestyle that they wanted to have. But as they see prices increase and they're not getting any more money because they're retired, then they're the ones that suffer, and they realize that their plans are being overturned or upended by the, like you said, the deception and the cheating of the other people. Is that fair?
That's That's exactly what happens. And, you know, it's like I say, I wish a lot more people understood this, and especially Christians really need to understand this, because this violates God's law. It violates the Ten Commandments, you know, thou shalt not steal. Mm. And if inflation counterfeiting is stealing the honest labor from other people, it's robbing them of what they've worked to earn. It's a transfer of wealth, redistribution of wealth from those who produce the money, from those who actually work to produce the goods and services that back the money. Essentially, you know, it's theft. And so it directly violates God's law. And there's even there's passages in the Bible that we can definitely see oppose inflation as dishonesty, and some of these things are some of the reasons Israel went into captivity, that God harshly judged people because, you know, he calls them thieves.
Yeah, I was wondering if maybe my understanding is wrong of this passage, but I think it might apply the passages that have to do with equal weights and measures. So for those listening, like, I get, like, in the ancient world, obviously you have, you know, a 5-pound weight or whatever, and 10-pound weight, and you know, when I want to buy sugar or something like that, measure it out. And but if you were a little sneaky and you said it was a 5-pound weight, but it was really 4 pounds, then basically you can get 5 pounds worth of money, or money for 5 pounds of sugar, but you're only giving the person 4 pounds of sugar, so you have a dishonest weight and measure. Do you see those laws applicable to the issue of inflation?
Yes, I definitely do. Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 15. God says, thou shalt not have in thy bag divers weights, a great and a small. Mm-hmm. Thou shalt not have in thine house divers measures, a great and a small. So the weights and the measures need to be perfect. Verse 15, but thou shalt have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure shalt thou have, that thy days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. So, you know, God's promise to Israel that they'll be in the promised land seemed to depend on them having honest transactions that didn't rob people by manipulating the money, or the way to measure the money. We see the effects of inflation in Scripture, where the curses of God, for instance, in Isaiah chapter 1, verses 22 through 23, says, thy silver has become dross, thy wine mixed with water, or in other words, diluted. Thy princes, you know, the rulers, are rebellious and companions of thieves. Everyone loves gifts and follows after rewards. They judge not the fatherless, neither do the cause of the widow come unto them. So that sounds like inflation there. There's a dilution of wine and silver there. Inflation hurts people on fixed incomes, those living off savings and retirement. The poor, the fatherless, and the widows suffer, as the passage says. They suffer the most, and God calls these rulers thieves for doing that.
So, I mean, I know we could definitely go on for hours, so much to talk about there too, but I do want to spend some time, you know, we've painted kind of a little depressing picture, you know, the state of things here. But as Christians who really care about, you know, justice or things like that, God's law or fairness and that kind of thing, what should Christians be either doing or advocating for in order to kind of maybe turn back things a little bit, or kind of fix things a little bit? Like, 'cause it seems like we're so far down this rabbit hole. How do we begin to work our way back?
I mean, I definitely think that properly educating people on these matters, as we kind of discussed, is part of them. Parents teach your children about the value of a dollar, you know, the honest labor, and economics, the biblical sound money, and the problems of why the government's so corrupt, as the Bible says, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, which some coveted after have pierced them through their with many sorrows. And we see that's what the government does by loving money, loving creating money, loving what money buys by stealing from people. And so it starts with education. Christians really need to understand how serious this is, that really the engine for inflation, which is counterfeiting and theft, is the engine for all, you know, virtually all the corruption we see in government. It's it's ultimately a cause for unjust wars. You know, in Christianity we have the just war theory, but we haven't really seen a just war for a long time. Like, governments are quick to go to war because they have an inflationary money system that hides the costs of war, and they want to go on foreign adventuring, and people just, you know, think that there's really no cost to war. But, you know, that's another cause, a moral problem with inflation. So I think, you know, educating people about that, if we really understood this, then perhaps Christians would really change their voting and not just be manipulated by, say, the two-party system. They would start to demand that if someone wants their votes, they got to end the corruption. And you can't end the corruption if you have a corrupt government with a corrupt money spigot, allowing them to spend money on things unjustly, rob people, destroy savings. You know, it's it's completely unbiblical. So we need to understand that and make that a major part of how we fight for justice, you know, true justice, not social justice, but, you know, justice, equality under the law, under God's law, and that, you know, we can start from the ground up, fight in for justice in local governments. You know, there's the principle of the lesser magistrate, and then work our way up from there. But anyone who demand that anyone who wants your vote will fight against the corruption of the unjust money system.
You know, I was thinking of, because we could pick on, certainly we can pick on, let's say, the Democratic Party, but we could also, you know, there's some blame to be given to the Republicans, who have become also fiscally irresponsible, voting for and in support of, you know, stimulus checks and things like that. And I know that there was a time in the past, quasi-recent past, with the Tea Party movement, where there was an attempt to try to introduce some kind of restraint and integrity amongst the politicians, and so I certainly would advocate for that kind of an integrity, and I do think that whether you're Democrat or Republican, you need to hold, you know, the people that you vote for accountable for their wicked spending practices. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yes, definitely. And of course, when it comes to the two parties that we have shoved down our throats, it's hard for me to even conceive of voting for a Democrat. You know, they're like just rotten to the core. You know, I cannot vote for anyone who supports abortion or, you know, homosexuality, transgenderism. You know, I'm conservative that way. Yeah. You know, it's like absolute corruption there. And then I know a lot of Republicans are, you know, it's like there may be a little bit better, but, you know, it's like, okay, if the Republicans are our hope, you know, we got to hold their feet to the fire and not, you know, just simply vote for them out of spite for the Democrats. I know I could get crucified by some of my fellow Christian conservatives for that, but I'm not one who favors the two-party system. I'm not one who, like, you know, votes Republican Party ticket because I'm scared of the Democrats. I'm going to vote my conscience, and, you know, I'd say, hey, if you want my vote, you've got to support the truth, period.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Dan, and I think that's an important perspective to have. Yeah, and a mature one that I would echo you on that and encourage people to vote in accordance with their conscience and not be necessarily married to one party or the other. I mean, I know that our time slips us by, but the last question I wanted to ask is, how can folks get to learn more about you, your ministry, your podcast? Where can they find information about you or go to support you online?
Well, my podcast is Truth Espresso. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned before, you can get to the website for that. That's www.truthespresso.com, and you can see all the episodes I have there. And Truth Espresso really is about seeking truth within the Word of God. I like to focus on things that a lot of people forget. Truth Espresso has a lot of focus on things like theology proper. I have a lot on Christology, and a lot of Christians don't think much of the depth of doctrines like the Trinity, the incarnation, who Jesus Christ is, and the nature of the atonement, how all that relates, and church history. So I get into that a lot. I try to be a little entertaining with that, because I also have a series going on, Is Jesus Like? Different superheroes, and each superhero represents a particular era about Jesus from church history. So we get to learn a little bit of church history by thinking about superheroes. And I also deal with some political and economic topics, because I hope that I can really educate Christians on things that, you know, might be ignorant about, and realize how serious, as I hope our discussion reveals, how serious and how corrupt things like the monetary system is. And we might look at the surface sometimes and see, like, oh, the government's doing this or that, and you think, well, why are they able to do that? It's because, what's the root of the problem? Mm-hmm. And so we get into there on episodes of Truth Espresso. And that's truthespresso.com, the website for my podcast.
Awesome.
I'm also on Facebook, Daniel Minnick. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that, Dan. And again, I will definitely ask folks to send you any questions. If they have any questions about topics such as economics, certainly they can ask me as well, but I'll probably just forward them to you, because I might not be able to answer them to the level that you can. But I really appreciate you coming on the show today to talk about this important topic. And, you know, it's definitely something that I'm passionate about too. And I'm also trying to learn how to apply God's law in every area of life, and economics is very complicated, and there's so much to learn about it. But I'm thankful for men like you who are doing that, and also touching on so many other topics, because there's a lot to cover out there, and we all have to be working together to educate others and proclaim the truth. So thank you again for coming out today.
Yes, thank you, Eric. It was definitely a pleasure to be on Governed by God.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that discussion that I had with Daniel Minnick, and I know I enjoyed it. There was much that we could continue talking about. Economics is an important topic, a kind of a complicated one in a lot of ways, but as Christians, there's so many things we need to think about and to think through, especially as we're reflecting on God's law. And so, please, I encourage you to take a look at the Truth Espresso podcast and look at some of the other topics that Daniel Minnick talks about, especially on the matter of economics. So you can go again to www.truthespresso.com to find more about his podcast. If you have any questions about the podcast, or if you want to send any questions to me and I can forward them to Daniel Minnick, please just email me at thegbgpodcast@gmail.com. You can also go to Facebook, look at Governed by God or the GBG podcast, and reach out to me there, as well as other social media avenues. So again, thank you for your time, and until next time, take care and God bless.